Backstage with Robert Emery.
Welcome to episode 17 of the Backstage with Robert Emery podcast. This is part two of my conversation with Sarah Miles. Sarah's an incredible lady, and it's taken us a long, long time to get this part published, but I'm so excited it has been. Now, there's some difficult conversations, there's some explicit language, and there's some very interesting ideas in here. Keep going with it. She's a fascinating lady, and I promise you, you'll come away listening to this episode thinking, wow, what a perspective on life. So here we go, part two with Sarah Miles. So after you were with Robert for 7 years, if you don't mind me asking, why did you fall apart? What happened?
Well, now this is the bit which I'm not allowed to speak of quite yet, because of the other thing I'm doing, which I can't speak of, which is all connected. I will be speaking out about everything quite soon. And it's heavy stuff. It's heavy stuff why Robert and I parted.
But you're not allowed to...
I'm not allowed to say it. Because I was... Well, anyway. I can't say. It's so terrible. I haven't said for all these years, and now that I feel so free that I want to speak out about the truth of it, I'm not allowed to, for the moment.
Okay.
Because they're both tied up together.
Okay.
And in talking about one, I cancel out the other.
Okay. And is this in connection? I mean, listeners, please note, you know, Sarah and I have not had conversations about what we should cover and what we should not cover. So this is, you know, you're hearing it live, as it were. There's no hidden parts of this. So has this got anything to do with what happened in, I think it was Arizona?
Yeah.
With the man who loved cat dancing?
Mm-hmm.
It's to do with that.
It is, yes.
And that's the subject that you're not...
I can't speak of it.
...allowed to talk about. Okay. But I'm going to... Okay, I'm going to probe you a bit more on this, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And you can keep on batting back
answers
of, I'm not allowed to speak about it. But for me, this is a little bit like being lucky enough to interview somebody like Beethoven and turning around and saying to Beethoven, how do you manage to compose when you can't hear? And he said, I'm not prepared to talk about that. Well, that's quite a fundamental part of your life, your path in life. And I think what happened in 1973 with this particular topic is quite an important path in your life.
Indeed.
It certainly changed life. So if you're not allowed to talk about it, I'm at least going to quickly sum up as to what happened, or at least what I've been able to ascertain what happened. You were in Arizona, it was February, filming, and you were starring opposite Burt Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a business manager called David Whiting?
Mm-hmm.
Question, and I hope you can answer certain bits about this. What does a business manager actually do? I'm just intrigued by that from...
Well, unfortunately, he wouldn't have been in Gila Bend had it not been for the fact that he got me this role, and every single big star was after this role. We all wanted it because it came from a very successful book, and it was a huge part for a woman, and a great part, there aren't many. So everybody was after it.
And
this guy...
And he managed to get it for you.
Because he was the showbiz West Coast correspondent for Time magazine, and he came into my life by doing a cover story on me and my husband. That's how he arrived in our lives.
I see. Fine. So because he managed to get you the role, he was there with you
representing... I couldn't stop him.
Yeah.
But at least he came with his girlfriend, who was the nanny of my son. So, because he was obsessed with me, and it's a horrible thing. If anybody's ever been... The object of obsession, they will know that there is nothing on this earth more horrific.
Mm.
Nothing.
A lot of weight.
Nothing.
On your shoulders.
Nothing more awful than somebody who is obsessed with you. Nothing.
Okay. So you were filming, and I think it was Burt Reynolds' birthday, actually.
It was.
You were 31 at the time. I'm not sure how old Burt Reynolds would have been, about 36 maybe?
I haven't a clue.
Yeah, I would have thought about,
I don't know.
I would have thought roughly about my age. very large moustache he had. And
very thick toupee and yes, very high heels.
Yes, I don't have a toupee, nor moustache, nor high heels yet.
I am relieved.
And anyway, you were filming, you went out for a party, came back at 3 o'clock in the morning. The report I've read, which is based upon the legal case that happened with the judge or whatever it was over in the States, said that you came back to your apartment at 3 o'clock. David Whiteley.
I first went into Bert's room.
Right, sorry.
Because one of the actors in it, called Bo Hopkins, I left Bert's party. It was a party that was being given by a big TV people called Merv Griffin Show. And they were next to the Johnny Carson Show, and they were hot stuff. And they were doing this whole program on Bert and his birthday. So Bert invited me, would I accompany him, since his girlfriend was in L.A. And Robert was at home. So I went with him to the party. And, of course, as usual, I didn't want to stay very long. So Lee J. Cobb, a fantastic actor, wanted me to go home in his Maserati Ferrari, which he just had bought up.
Yeah.
So we went home that way. I told Bert that I was tired and wanted to go to bed because I had a big huge scene to do next day, when I had to be tussling with Jack Warner, another great actor. So I said to Bert, I'm tired, I'm going home now, and I'll see you in the morning, blah, blah. So I went home with... But when I got back to the motel, all the cowboys were dancing, and so I went to have a little bit of a dance. And then... what's his name? Bo Hopkins was dancing with me. He said, you know, you told Bert that you were going home because you were tired, and he's just seen you here, you're in trouble... You'd better go and say sorry. I said, what? How would he care? Honey, you told him you were tired and here you are dancing. Oh, I thought, all right. So I knocked on his door.
Sorry, just to pause you for a second. At this point, I'm assuming Burt Reynolds was a big superstar.
He was so big. He was the hottest thing ever.
And were you intimidated by this?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not a bit. But he had... what, 5 or 6 films lined up?
Yeah.
Mostly with MGM.
He was like the Mr. Man at the time. He was the big thing. Okay, so you went and knocked on his door.
And he was using my very own little masseuse called Let's Go, little Japanese girl, because I did my own stunts on that film, I'm proud to say. I even fell off a horse on, because I can fall off horses very well. You can do anything with practice. It isn't clever. Yeah. It's just practice is all. That's all anything is practice. People say you're clever. No, you're not. You've just put in the discipline and the work to pull it off. So I could pull off a horse. And there she was walking all over Bert's back. I said, oh, I'll leave you two alone. That's what you're doing. And I'm going to bed tonight. And anyhow, but I'm sorry if I went dancing, but I can't resist it with the Wranglers, you know, the cowboys. So we're in a quadrangle here, in a square, half square. Is that what it's called when you're like that?
Yep.
I come out of Bert's room and I go with my nanny's doors open because we have adjoining suites with my son.
Yeah.
My son was asleep. Nanny was asleep. I go through my adjoining room and the curtains move of the cupboards and out comes David. Now, he was a nutter, David. Brilliant man. I had him checked out by the head of Time magazine when I was in America before he came home. I wanted to check that he was for real because he seemed so weird. So I had lunch with de Grunwald, who was the head of Time magazine, who told me that he was the most brilliant journalist they had. He was a chess champion. His mother worked for Time. You won't do better than David Whiteley. He'd changed him from football to showbiz because he was so brilliant. So I thought, well, that's good enough for me, you know. So he got me the role. So now we're back in. I said goodnight to Bert. I'm now coming through Nanny's room into my room. Curtains come out, and there is David looking more nutty than I've ever seen him before. He says, you're late. Look at the time. Where have you been? It's late. Look at the time. I said, you know damn well where I've been. And then he began to punch me, which he's never done before. And I was being punched bad in the face. So I call out what was her name? The girl, I can't remember her name. Jenny or something. Help! Help! And then she comes in, tired. She was standing there watching me. I said, do something. So she got a chair and hit him, which had no effect at all. I said, get Bert, because I knew Bert was awake. Mm. So she disappears. And as soon as David heard the word Bert, he went out my room. Bert came through to me, saw my face, and said, Jesus Christ, start bathing it with ice. I'll be back. And he went out this way after David. And about, this is what I can't remember how long it was before Bert came back. Because if you'd been punched up, you lose sense of time.
Sure.
A bit,
you know. Yeah. And the whole thing must have been terrifying for you.
It's horrendous. Because I've been protecting this guy for 3 years. He'd attempted suicide twice. My husband knew how brilliant he was, so he came to work for us on our film, Lady Caroline Lamb, as the press agent. He was brilliant at that. He's brilliant at anything he does, but he's nuts, you know.
Yes.
A lot of brilliant people are nuts, you know. Did you know that?
I did.
And a lot of bipolar people are so brilliant.
Mm. Yeah.
Most of them, in fact. Mm. I don't know any stupid bipolar person in my head.
No, nor do I, to be fair.
The more depressed you get, the more intelligent you are, because you're more linked to reality than you are hope, you know. Anyway, so Bert finally comes back and says, honey, you're really bad. You're really badly done over here. Come on, I'm going to bathe you.
I think you'd broken a finger or something.
He had?
You had broken a finger.
Oh, I don't know, maybe. I'm breaking everything all the time. I lose track of what I break. So he takes you back into his place, his room, and he puts me on bed and he starts to bathe me. And he says, here, take these. And he gave me a couple of pills to calm me down. Now, that was my mistake. I never take a pill from anybody. Mm. Ever. But I was feeling, and I don't take pills, so I mean, I would take anything at that moment to calm down because I was, you know, pretty badly punched up and I had a big scene to do the next morning. So I went to sleep with him bathing my face. Mm. Next morning, I wake.
They were sleeping pills, I assume.
What?
They were sleeping pills, I assume, to calm down.
I assume there was something pretty heavy because I was out, out like a light. I look out the window and there's the whole of the Merv Griffin camera crew. And then I think, Christ, David Whiting, where is he? Where's my son? Where's my son? Is my son safe? Is my son? So I say, Bert, I've got to go. My son, I'm just beginning to remember last night. I've got to go. He said, honey, you can't look out the window. I said, you know something? I don't care. I care about my son. So I put on this dressing gown and I just shot out his door and shot. I don't think anybody noticed me. I went so fast. Anyway, back in my own area, through the nanny's room again, and there was my son on the floor playing with a train set. And I moved past it into my place. And then I think, God, I must go to the loo. And I went into the bathroom. And there was David dead on my bathroom floor. With his, on his back, because his stomach was up. And he was covered in pills. Mm. And the rest, I can't tell.
Sure. So, after that, obviously, filming stopped for a while, must have done. And then my understanding is there was a court case and...
there was the inquest, you see.
The inquest.
You have to have an inquest if someone's dead.
Yes.
It's what you do.
Yes.
And I'd had 3 suicides before this. Mm. So I sort of knew about inquests.
Yeah, and the inquest said he had committed an overdose. He committed suicide.
I don't know. No, there were 3 inquests. There were 3 autopsies, I mean.
Oh, right.
First one was suicide. Second one was murder. And the third one was suicide again.
Okay.
And his mother came, and she was a very brilliant woman, his mother, and she came out to me and says, you've got to tell the truth. You've got to... I said, I can't. I can't. Mm.
Okay. You finished the movie and it was released.
Mm-hmm. Never saw it. Never wanted to see it.
Obviously, it remains speculation to what happened to David Whiting. And that's the bit which
It's all coming back now.
Yeah, sure.
2 people are doing a book on him. It's all going to come out in the open.
Yeah.
It's all going to come out.
I know. And that's the bit which I think you probably can't talk about or don't want to talk about right now.
And that's the sort of thing that I don't want to speculate, and I don't ever want this medium of podcasting to be a speculation shit show. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in facts. So I'm not even going to push you on that, because, as you say, if it's going to come out, it's going to come out what actually happened to that man. But what I do want to ask is, you know, Burt Reynolds, regardless of what he may or may not have done, he did help you out that evening by... well, actually, no, he didn't, did he? Because David Whiting had ran off before Burt Reynolds had come in. I was going to say he managed to save you, but he certainly... Okay, well, he looked after you and you know, calmed you down, helped calm you down. Did you... You finished the film. You had to do all of that and obviously tie up all of that. Did you ever see him again or speak to him again?
No, alas, I wanted to. I was on a tour of another film of mine called Hope and Glory with John Borman. We were in Canada doing a tour, a press tour for the film. And he directed him in his great movie, Deliverance. That's why he was close to Burt, because he'd got Burt to be famous, after all. He was responsible for his fame. He said, well, let's go and have lunch with him and talk the whole thing through. So... I hadn't told him this bit. There's one bit that I can't tell. I can't. It's very sad that I can't.
And what,
but I love my family.
Okay.
So
this is to do with your family. So it's a personal reason you can't tell. It's not a legal reason. It's just, it's your choice just to not talk about that.
It's difficult to know whether it's legal or not.
Okay.
I'm afraid at this moment, I'm not being difficult. I'm a very open person, but I really can't at this moment in time. Can't. So we went to have lunch with Burt, and he never showed up.
And you never saw him again?
Never saw him again.
Do you think that whole saga, that whole scandal, I suppose would be the best word, do you think, aside from the emotional effect it must have had on you, do you think it has affected your career?
Let me just say what happened here. When this all came out, my parents have lived in this home where I was born, brought up in Essex, in the countryside. My mother couldn't go near the village any longer because I was a murderess. So they had to move home to where they would be less, you know, so they went to live in Brighton, away from... My husband and I broke up because of it. My family wouldn't speak to me because of it. So... Did my life change? Yes, it did. And I am innocent of everything. Mm. Even if they claim I was having an affair with this Whiting chap. No, I wasn't. Not for 3 years. I happened to slip up with him in a cupboard in LA. That's because my husband wouldn't come to the Oscars with me. Do you imagine going to Oscars without your husband, who'd actually, you know, he wouldn't come. He was too busy working. Mm. Workaholic.
Just because your husband... He actually won 2 Oscars, didn't he?
He did.
2 Oscars, 2 BAFTAs, 3 Golden Globes, 3 a Tony.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite an astonishing...
He was a little wizard.
Yeah.
My little
but
wizard.
But he wouldn't come to the Oscars with you. I mean, that must have been quite...
I was devastated. Mm. He was so excited about what he was writing that he thought I could go alone. It's not a good thing to do, to send your wife alone.
No. So, it's... It had a profound effect on you and your family. One of the things that you've already said to me today is talking about the path of life and staying neutral and keeping as open as you can to letting things happen to you in life. And your epiphany happened in 1973 as well?
This was... 2 years after that.
Okay, so 2 years after that. So
no, 1 year. One year after that.
So the question I have for you then is, obviously this was a horrible, horrible thing to have happened for everybody involved. But, you know, this many years on, you're older, you're wiser, one would hope. Do you feel now everything happens for a reason? Do you feel
yeah,
like...
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you must learn the lessons therein. And of course, the harder you're hit, the greater the blessing. Because you're expanding your own Atma, which is who you are. Atma is so important. Anyway. Oh, God, if I rule the world, I would change it. But anyway,
yeah,
there we are.
So it's not something that... I mean, obviously, an individual died. It's not something which you could ever bless. But it is something which you've managed in your... in your own psyche to turn around and see as something which...
It's very simple to turn it around because innocence is a beautiful thing, you know. It's so strong, it keeps you strong because you know that you've done no harm of any kind and that is what keeps you strong.
So you mentioned your son, Tom?
Tom.
So he was 5 when this happened.
Yeah, and he said Bert did it the next day.
Did he really?
Yes.
Out of the mouths of babes. Let's not discuss that bit anymore. He was 5 at the time, just so we've got any coverage there. So Tom also had, you know, this is not a podcast about Tom, so, you know, you must talk to me about Tom as much or as little as you want. But I know he had a challenging life and has come through it.
He certainly did.
Do you just want to talk about that for a brief moment, just from a parent's point of view? Because, you know, I've got Teddy, he's 3, and at the moment, you know, the hardest thing about having a 3-year-old is the tantrums that a 3-year-old has, and that's it. So, yes, they can be quite frustrating at the time you're having to deal with them, but in the grand scheme of life, they're not going to really cause a problem, as long as he sort of grows up on the straight and narrow path that we will try and guide him. But nevertheless, you never know the path that somebody's life is going to take. We can't predict the future. At least I can't. So as a parent, Tom had a difficult life. How did you cope with that? How did you deal with that? And what wise words of wisdom would you give to me to say that when my little Teddy is no longer a little Teddy and he's towering above me, how should I help him grow up to be a sensible, brave, outgoing young man that he deserves to be?
Well, I'm not the right person to be asking, really, because I think I failed as a mother, and it's something that I have to live with the rest of my life. I'm not a failed mother now, we're very close, but during that David Whiting thing, I was blown off course a bit. And after my epiphany, I was told I had to go into a silent situation, a retreat, for 3 years and learn to write, dance and sing. And I sent my son home to his father. And that's where I failed. And I'm really bad about that. I chose God over my son. Do I regret it? No, I don't regret it. Because I made the choice. He'd been expelled from all the schools that were in LA. There wasn't another school I could send him to, because he'd run out of schools. He was a...
So, just to clarify, you were living in L.A. at this point because...
I couldn't bear the gossip about murderers. I was a murderess.
So, yeah.
So if you're a murderess, the best place to go is not up the Himalayas, or if you're accused of being a murderess, rather, not up the Himalayas, but somewhere where you can be a tiddler in an ocean of sharks. Mm. So I went to L.A., and it was a perfect choice because I was free.
Yeah. But Tom didn't get on so well there.
He loved it. He was just expelled from everywhere.
Yeah, sure.
Just like me. And how can you tell a son that you're naughty when his father was expelled from Manchester Grammar School and another school? I was expelled from 4 schools. So he wants to beat our record. Mm. And he did. He got 10.
Wow.
Hey, 10. Good boy. Good boy. Oh,
So he came back to England and stayed with Robert.
Yes, and of course I came with him on holidays and everything. He went to boarding school because we thought that would be a better solution for him. because he was so naughty. I mean, he was just amazingly naughty. I couldn't cope with him alone at all. I had not a hope in hell. And this is why I truly believe that motherhood is number one job on earth. And yet they're sending every mother out to work. How can we have peace on our streets when you haven't got the yin and the yang for family? Mm. You've got to have both. Mm. Otherwise, a woman alone, I don't believe. There are millions of cases of where they've been hugely successful. And bravo, I take my hat off to those women more than anybody else who's got a lone job of looking after a kid. God bless them all, because I'm full of respect. I failed. End of story.
So your son came back to England. You stayed in the States for a while. This is where you got to know Steven Spielberg.
No, I know Steven, but we came together right after Gila Bend, before I had my epiphany, in that period of time.
Okay. And you were with Stephen was that a proper relationship? You were,
yes,
and it was public. It was.
Well, I mean, we were seen out together. We didn't say bam, ba, bam, ba, bam, ba, ba, but we were sort of, we were both free. Yeah. Why not?
So you were with him for 2 years, and that was around the time that he was making Jaws, I think.
That's right. It wasn't quite 2 years, but yes, he was doing Jaws. Well, he didn't. He only wanted to get E.T. off the ground. Not E.T., the other one. Close Encounters. That was his baby. He was so excited about it. But he could not get anybody interested. So we both had the same agent, Guy McElwain.
Was this before he actually became...
Oh, yes, he was nobody.
A huge...
I wanted to meet him because I'd just seen a movie that was one of the best movies I've ever seen, which was called Duel. Do you know the movie?
I don't know.
Oh! It's a black and white movie, and it's just this big, ugly lorry chasing a guy in a car.
I've heard about it,
I don't think there's a better film to be made than that. It is so cheap and so brilliant that I was really turned on, and I wanted to meet the bloke who wrote it, so I was introduced to him, and that's how it started. And that was before anything else had happened to him. He wasn't well known then at all. But he had a vision, you know, when he was a little boy. He was walking home in Phoenix, Arizona, walking home from school with a satchel on his back, and suddenly the skies opened, and his knees buckled, and he fell to the ground. And he looked up, and he saw this golden mountain with Hollywood written on it. And he's very embarrassed about this, but he was sitting on a throne at the top. And he went into catharsis, and he went home, and so shook and wasn't very well for a while. And then when he really came to again, he said, "Daddy, buy me a camera for my birthday." Oh, wow. And that's how it started for him.
So I guess at some point that relationship ended its course, and that's when you essentially moved back to...
Well, I went and did The Sailor Who Fell from Grace to the Sea, where I had my epiphany, and therefore I closed shop. I went into silence or retreat for... The 3 years.
And have you remained in contact with Steven Spielberg? Yes.
Not lately, no.
No.
But I mean, it's no problem.
Yeah. And so you went into your silent retreat. And go back to Tom, your son. So he came back and spent time with his father. And after 3 years or so, you came out of silent retreat. What happened then?
What happened then was
and obviously Tom's not here to talk about his life story, so it's unfair to dive into his story without his permission, actually. But nevertheless, that's why I said I'm intrigued from this from a parent's point of view, that he had problems that he had to deal with, and it was very difficult for you as a parent to deal with it.
Yeah, I was. He's a very powerful, very brilliant man, my son. I hate to say this, but he's excessively brilliant. And I just wasn't up to the mark with him. I couldn't. He always had an answer for everything. He's so clever. He's so very clever. He's a wheeler dealer. I'm so proud of him, actually. I really am. Anyway, where were we? I was still in L.A., And what happened then? I got a call from Robert Bolt out of the blue. He said, I'm working in Tahiti with David Lean. We're writing Mutiny on the Bounty. And I've got a little problem in my heart. And David doesn't want me to have a heart attack proper so he sent him back to L.A., where I was living, to go to hospital and have a check to see whether his heart's all right. Because David didn't want to be responsible in Tahiti for a big heart attack.
Yes.
He'd lose him, wouldn't he?
Yes.
So Robert was very excited and asked me out to dinner. So we went out to dinner and we sat on Venice Beach at sunset and we talked everything through. This is before he went into hospital. And we decided, well, he did more than me, that the only way forward for our son was for us to get back together again because we were both failing at taking care of him apart. So I adored Robert, always did. Our breakup was not a normal breakup. It was a complete severing, thanks to the media. The media destroyed us, no doubt about it. Well, it's
so actually, you didn't communicate that.
What?
For that period of time where you were not together.
No, we didn't communicate.
Okay.
No, except for holidays.
Yes,
And so he said, let's get back together again. And I'll never forget it, the sunset on that, you know, on the sea. And we had a bottle of champagne there with us for our picnic on the beach. And it was quite divine. And I was absolutely thrilled that we were going to try again because I really wanted to make a success of being a mother. I certainly couldn't do it without the dad around. So that was, to me, just perfect.
Were you not completely shocked and blown away and gobsmacked and all those other words to use, that essentially there's the man that you had married and then had divorced, and then through the media you had not communicated and spoken with him as a friend, in inverted commas?
Oh, we sort of had, but only because of things dealing with Tom.
Yeah. But then he comes back to you and says, you know, I've got a problem with my heart. I need to get it seen tomorrow in an operation, otherwise I may have a heart attack. Can we get back together again? I mean, that's quite a...
Well, I think he'd plotted it way back. But, I mean, the point is that's what happened. So he went into hospital the next day. And then I went in the next day to see him in intensive care. And he was all right. And the next day I went, he was a vegetable. He couldn't speak or move. Mm. And he couldn't speak for, I think, 2.5 years. And his first words he spoke was, "Fucking hell!" I'll never forget it, the first words he spoke. So there he was. Golly, was he fine about it, you know. Here you have, at 49 years old, our greatest screenwriter.
And just...
our greatest raconteur.
Screenwriter. He's, you know, he wrote Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, The Mission, A Man for All Seasons, just to name a few.
I mean, and many more. Cal,
yes.
I Am, Rise of Daughter, half of Mutiny on the... River Kwai. On and on and on and on.
And at 49 this happened.
49. Completely vegetable.
And is this when you bought the manor house here and you...
He didn't buy it. We bought it jointly. Everything we've ever done, we've done jointly.
But that's what I mean. At that point, this is...
No, we were in London.
Oh, I see.
We were in Hammersmith on the Mall. We were up there for... He couldn't get down to the country because he needed all these special things for his stroke. You know, he had to learn how to talk, walk. He couldn't do anything. So we were in London. And then when he was sort of coming a bit better... See, what happened when I was a little girl, I have to go back here a minute. I was quite strange in that I could see colours around people's heads. I could see the etheric, which is a silver lining around the trees. You could learn how to see the etheric, actually. If you put your fingers up to the sun, you can learn to begin to see. It's a skin. If you're a healer, you work on the etheric skin. You don't touch the body. You work on the etheric. So I could see the etheric around everything. And I used to have visions in the palm of my left hand. And we were an atheist family, so everybody was terribly bored of my visions. Not now, Sarah, later. Well, I was called Puss Cat, actually. Not now, Puss Cat. And then one day I said, Daddy, look, what is it this time, Pussycat? Trying to be patient. And I said, ancient house, church, river, nestling near some woodland. And he said, so, what's that, Pussycat? I said, well, that's home, Daddy. And he said, we don't have a church or river here, Pussycat. I said, no, real home, stupid, kicking my pony on. And that remained with you, because if you have a vision of any kind, it never leaves you. It's part of eternity. You can't get rid of it. And when I met Robert, I spoke to Robert about this vision, and he wasn't very interested because he was a busy playwright, a scene writer, and indeed an atheist too. Second time around, after his stroke, one of the few words he said at the beginning of his, he said, let's go and find that vision in the palm of your hand. I said, what? And he remembered it and brought it back this time, which was fantastic. So we went house hunting all around the British Isles, trying to find ancient house, church, river, nestling near some woodland. And we didn't find it. 3 years we didn't find it. So we gave up and stayed where we were. And 2 weeks later, we found it. And here we are. Here I am. Thanks to Robert getting behind it for the first time after his stroke.
Well, it's a wonderful place.
It's a wonderful place, but it's also a wonderful vision.
Mm. So you've been here ever since then. Robert passed away.
He passed away in 1996. We had a wonderful burial here. We bunged him in the garden in a cardboard box, in a scarlet gown. And as we were walking him up to his where he wanted to be buried up here, the garden.
I was there earlier on.
You were there. He's hugely heavy because he was like 20 stone alive, so he was, must have been a lot more dead, you know. Mm. And he had these six pork barrels. And we got to the grave, which I dug myself, actually. I was quite proud of that. And the cat jumped in.
Oh, gosh.
So we couldn't.
Oh, God.
So I had to get into the grave to get the cat
out.
It was hilarious. The whole thing was quite lovely, actually.
I would like to talk about a couple of things, which I know are important for you, but I also know that they are something which a lot of people won't necessarily understand.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I want to talk about them, actually.
Right.
Crop circles is one.
Right, crop circles. Crop circles are a phenomenon which are quite extraordinary.
Now, I think what's happened here is that there is a group called the Expanding Heart Awareness Group. Is
mm-hmm.
that right? And this group, which I think you're part of, or you founded it, or you
yeah,
something to do with. In 2012, you offered, as part of this group, not you personally, but the group, offered £100,000 to anybody who could recreate the galaxy crop circle that appeared on Milk.
My God, you've done your homework, haven't you?
in Wiltshire in 2001.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are lots of people on the internet who say crop circles are a complete rubbish and they're done
of
by farmers.
That's what the government wants. Yeah.
Yep. And nevertheless, this organisation, or you with this organisation, have offered £100,000, so it's a huge amount of money, to anybody who can actually.
No, to the guys that claim they did the original.
Yes.
The galaxy, to do it again.
Yeah.
And we wanted the same conditions. I got the field, I rented out the whole field.
Yes. But they couldn't do it, or they didn't do it.
They would refuse it because they can't do it. This whole thing's ridiculous.
So what do you think?
That's why I could offer 100,000.
Yeah.
I had to put in escrow, but that 100,000 was for them if they did it.
Yeah.
And if I claimed to do the first, I think I'd do it again, wouldn't you, for 100,000?
But didn't.
Nobody. What's more, they came here and abused me. They came to my garden, they came to my front door, and they were nasty people.
So what do you believe crop circles are?
It's very simple. They're made out of sound and light. The only two people who have had it happen, a circle manifest around them, was a 6'4" Caucasian, white car mechanic, very simple guy, and his wife, who is a 4'9" black Jewess of the only couple of Jewish black tribes there are. And they were always mocked for looking so ridiculous together, because they did look ridiculous together. And they were walking home one night in Surrey, And very odd that it was Surrey, because most of them are further, you know, in the West Country or on the A272, but Surrey is very odd. And it was when the corn was still green, and they saw the corn green, yet the sunset was in it, like shimmering in a way that was not normal. How could the sunset be like a mirror on the corn? They couldn't understand. So they moved further in. You always go toward that to which you're curious. It's part of human nature. And one side of the field, the trees were not in coordination with their shadows. And there was a very odd feeling. And the other side was normal. They come further into the centre of the field, and they're about as far apart as the end of the... I'm not good at distances, but see where that the end of the conservatory is?
Yep. So that's about 5 metres away. I'm not sure what that is normally. Right. But,
and suddenly... Now, I made them both talk to me separately, not together, because I wanted to hear both their stories separate. And what was so interesting is they both used the same expression, which was very odd. They said, suddenly there was a bang of light. Now, that's a very odd thing to say. And they both said it.
Yeah.
This sent her cornrows, she had cornrows, out on end. His whole, everything was out. Everything, like two scarecrows. Oh, like this, across the... And they couldn't believe what was happening. And they came towards each other like this. Like, and then they looked down, and this whole circle was made within 3 seconds around them. Now, since then, well, when it first happened, they were so stunned that they went for the mail, the mirror. And the mirror wrote a piece on it. And then they had these guys coming down with their attaché cases saying, don't speak any more about this, we'll break your kneecaps. So they had to keep quiet. But the point is that he went deaf in one ear. It's called something, there's a name for it, the inner ear deaf thing. And she got cataracts very quickly.
Oh, really?
From the sound and the light. No, it's... What you do is you get some stubble and you set light to it. Dangerous, yeah, okay. You need smoke anyway. Do it however you want it, you need smoke. Then you put your finger up and you see which way the wind's blowing, and you've got a new corn circle, and you let the smoke go toward the corn circle. If it's a hoax, which there are many of, the government has seen to that, it goes straight over. If it's the real thing, that smoke can't penetrate the outer circle of the corn circle. It goes straight up into the air. So simple.
Have you ever seen that yourself?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's not the only way. You can tell by the energy in it. It's potent for the first... It dissipates after about 3 days. And different... If you get a beetle one, there's lots that came down like insects. They give you a bit of a headache and you're nauseous. But most of them are very uplifting. And it's curing Parkinson's. Yeah, I took a Parkinson guy up the road into one the other day or last summer. I made him lay in it. He's a complete disbeliever too, which doesn't help, but he thinks they're all made by hoaxes, you know. But I forced him to lay in it, and he's getting so much better. Really? Mind you, we do play ping pong a lot together. but he is getting better, and he won't admit it with that.
Talking about health and keeping on top of that, you're famous for drinking your own pee.
Yeah, yep.
Now... you know, there are actually lots of people in history who have done this, and there's books written about it, and there's all sorts of stuff. But you've had your fair share of bad press about this.
I have been ostracised for it. People go around me as if I'm a smelly bag lady.
Mm.
And I just bless them for their ignorance.
What do you feel it does for you? What's the advantage for you?
Well, I don't look too bad.
I mean, you look stunning.
And that ain't to do with facelifts.
Yeah.
It's fantastic, you see. When your baby comes, did you touch your baby when he first came out?
Yes.
Was he soft?
Yes.
Was his skin nice and soft?
No, I don't... In all honesty, he looked like a sort of... Sorry, Ted. A really ugly little alien. and he was very messy and... I don't really remember what he felt like. I just remember looking at him going, what is this thing?
Right. So enough. I can't... Very honest answer there.
Tell you that.
Well, what happens is when you come out of the womb, your skin is as soft, as soft, as soft. That is because you've been in your own pee for 9 months. What it does is you put it in your eyes, if your eyes are sore, you put it in your ears, you put it, you wash your hair in it, you smother your face in it.
But, well, the critics, of course, turn around and the simple argument is the pee is the stuff that your body is trying to get rid of.
It isn't, that's not right at all. It's coming through a great sieve of, you know, it's your very essence, of course. If you drink a lot, alcohol, I mean, if you take a lot of drugs, it ain't going to be too good. It's not the end of the world, but it's not as good as if you've got a clean diet. And if you have a clean diet, your pee is like water.
Mm.
Your pee is, you can't tell the difference between a glass of water and your own pee. Now, if that isn't something good to aim for, I don't know what is.
What
harm is it doing to anybody?
Absolutely not.
Why attack me? Everybody attacks me for something that is totally harmless.
Yep.
Are you hearing me here?
Yep.
So why am I being attacked?
Yep.
It's not harming them, is it?
No.
So what's going on here? Fear, 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 fear.
I think what's going on is that people are scared about things that they don't do. And
it's all fear-based. Their minds go weird, their eyes go weird, and they go into the fear syndrome, which is where we all are at today. Fear is the opposite to love, and there ain't no love.
I mean, as I said earlier, I had my fair share of, not like you, of course, but I've had my fair share of negative reaction for when I've conducted barefooted.
All right.
Because, you know, I like doing that. It's something I've done now for quite a number of years, and it's an unusual thing to do, and therefore people sort of, it's a bit like Marmite, isn't it? They fall on the fence of they absolutely love it or they absolutely hate it.
But let me just explain something about, since you've brought it up.
Yes.
I'm not a fool. I'm going to now speak out about it.
Well, that's why I brought it up.
It immunizes you against your own allergies. I started drinking it. You brought it up, and now I'm going to go on.
Great.
Right? Robert and I went to India to find out everything we could about Gandhi, on which he was writing a screenplay. Now, Gandhi was dead, but when we went, there were many people who were still alive who knew him well. So we went to visit all these people all over India who knew Gandhi well. It was a fantastic trip. Can't tell you what it was like. It's a learning curve for me too. But it was all this. And Robert was tearing his hair out because he thought, my God, I can't write a film script about this guy because we don't identify with saints. We only identify with men, not saints. So I haven't got a screenplay. I said, well, we've got to find somebody who's got something bad to say about him. You know? So we went on and on with the tour, which was a 6 weeks thing. And we get to his ashram. And the first thing, which I think is great, but this woman, beautiful, she's got a double barrel name, and I can't remember her name, but she was in the ashram. And she'd been there ever since. And she was beautiful. Absolute English rose, the epitome of, you know. And I said, I couldn't believe it. I thought she was about 50 and she was nearly 80. That shows you what she looked like. And she said, it's all due to drinking your own pee, because Gandhi had us all. First pee of the morning, last pee of night, mid-flow, toss back, a little glass like that. I was repulsed. I thought, ugh, how disgusting. So I was one of the many, or the millions, the trillions, who think it's disgusting, right? Now I'm in LA, and when I make a movie, I have to get up 2 hours before anybody else because I have a terrible thing here with my, what's it called, sinuses, and my eyes puff up, like today because I've got a cold, they puff up into little piss holes in the snow. So therefore, I've got to bathe them for 2 hours with ice in order to be able to function on the set. Now, I got quite tired of this. So I had a singing teacher in L.A. when my epiphany told me to, my life is my message, sing it, dance it, write it. I had to learn to sing because I was a joke singer. Couldn't sing a note. And he thought it was to do with this allergy. So he said, he was prepared to take me to all these alternative medicines that were happening in LA at that time. It was beginning of the alternative route. It was all happening suddenly in LA. Not here yet, but in LA. And nothing was working. So I said, would you like to try urinology? I said, what's that? He said, you go and you help me. So I went along and you sit in this room, very plush place, with my son, who's an asthmatic. I took him along too. And you wait for your turn, obviously, and then you go in. You both have to pee into a silver chalice mid-flow. We were given our silver little chalices, and we went. We both peed mid-flow, and we take it into this doctor who was Hungarian. Again, I thought he was like 15, he was 83, and so I was beginning to think there was something in all this. But we didn't want to drink it, so he gets it's injected back into your bum. That's what we did for 8 weeks, twice a week. My singing teacher was paying for this. He had such belief in my voice. So he was paying for all this. And my golly, you know, it began to happen that all my bagginess went away. Tom's asthma disappeared. That first 8 weeks was remarkable. But it was costly. It was costing my... And I couldn't ask him to go on. I either had to start paying myself because he insisted on paying. I didn't ask him to. He insisted. So I asked the doctor the final time. I said, look, do I have to pay for it? Can I do it? Of course. That's mid-flow. Every first morning pee, last night pee, mid-flow, just swig it back, finish. So that's what I did. My son would, of course, and he just continued on wheezing away and having asthma. So I have to say, it certainly does work. But you've got to remember that it doesn't taste like it smells. It tastes like a little beer, a different beer. And every day it's a different taste, but it's not unpleasant at all.
Fascinating.
But mind you, I eat clean and I drink clean.
Good. I mean, I never thought I'd discuss that, but it's...
It's important that people know that it does immunize. Very soon, antibiotics ain't going to be working.
Yes.
I think you're going to have a lot of people who are going to try this and they're going to be delighted.
Yeah.
Especially putting it on your skin. It's fantastic.
You became famous as an actress. And you're not the type just to sit at home doing nothing. No, you've not been acting in films now for a while.
Yeah.
So your life has moved on, and apart from the spiritual things we've touched on, and you have your meditation retreats here where people come around and you do that. And what else have you been doing from an artistic, creative side over the years?
Over the years, well, I've written four books, all have been published, not self-published, but published properly. Not that the other way isn't proper. Whatever way you can get your feelings out there, great. So I've done a lot of... I've done film scripts. I've done... I keep doing my one-woman thing very quietly because I'm going to do it big time again. The stories are too good not.
You write poems as well, don't you?
I do poems. I've got about 220 of them now, which are good enough for publishing. A few of them need a bit of cleaning up, but I'll be putting out a book of those.
So what's next for Sarah Mars?
What's next for Sarah Mars?
Are you finally going to just sit back, relax, and just take it easy, or are you going to continue working?
I haven't started. I haven't begun. Believe me, I haven't begun.
I mean, you're a fascinating person. There's a question which I ask everybody, which is your prediction what the entertainment industry will be in 20 years' time from now. And the entertainment industry is obviously a very big industry, so you can narrow that down to films or television or poetry or books. Well, you can narrow it down to whatever you want, but you know, some people I ask about orchestral music and they tell me about what they predict will be happening with orchestras in 20 years' time. Why don't we go with films? That's your sort of starting platform of your life from a career. So what in 20 years' time, what do you predict predict that will be?
It's very difficult, isn't it, really? It's quite a difficult question, that. I mean, what do I feel? Because I think it's very difficult when everything's been done, you know, and people have to go to great lengths to shock in order to be seen. Because everything's been done and said, and in fact, if you look at talking movies, movies are a damn sight better than they are now. We've lost the plot somehow with movies. I think that's because of this thing of having three acts that they do. You can tell the end before the beginning nowadays because it's all done, you know, in this awful way. So I don't really know the answer to your question. I think there's going to be a whole new revolution in spirituality, which is going to take us to all kinds of different realms that we don't know about right now. It's going to be an extraordinarily wonderful time because we're going to have to change our ways because robots are coming, whether we like it or not, and robots don't do spirit. They don't go near spirit because they can't. So everything to do with art is going to become more and more important, obviously, because they can't do that. Well, they can, but they can't be a ballet dancer, for instance, can they?
No.
So you have to choose a profession where they can't do it because they're going to be doing everything else. So it's going to be a very extraordinary time, I think, because of this. And I think we're going to have to really look deeper into who we are because we're not fulfilling potential in any way at all. We're full of victimization, we're angry, we're full of fear, and quite rightly so. We're in a mess.
So, you know, it's very public that the arts are struggling and have been for quite some time now.
And they've always been struggling.
Well,
I can't remember a time when they weren't struggling, to be honest.
Yeah, but, you know, there was certainly a golden age of cinema. Television, I think, actually is in its heyday right now. Some of the drama coming out on television is far superior than...
What?
Some of the drama that's coming out on television is far superior than... some of the rubbish that's on films. But do you think you think then, because of the fact that, as you say, robots are coming, you think that maybe 20 years' time, 40 years' time, 50 years' time, who knows however long it'll take, but actually the arts will have a real renaissance and come back?
Oh, very much so. When robots are here, we're going to really turn a corner and go deeper into our own psyches as to what we are capable of. Everybody has such enormous potential that it's not being tapped at all. But once you get all the robots doing the menial stuff, then people who are doing the menial stuff now will begin to realise that they too have great creativity and talent. And it'll all change so quickly, I think, because we're safe when it comes to spiritual stuff.
So what's the one thing... Well, there may be more than one thing, but I would only like one thing from you that you still would like to achieve in your life.
I like to see us waltzing into the golden age before I die. I'd love to see it all change. I'd love to see us going small is beautiful rather than global, because I think that globalization lacks humanity. I think that it's fine for the elite who can travel, they can go everywhere, houses everywhere. You check with those members of parliament who are Remainers. They've all got some link, heavy link to Europe. So it's the people I care about, oddly enough, which is the people who can't travel, the people who have got no neighbourhood, the people who yearn for a community. Therefore, I think we should go small. We should divide even England into Wessex, Cornwall, East Anglia.
Well, it used to be like that, didn't it? You used to have essentially the king of Wessex.
Exactly.
And the king of...
Yeah. So we then... Everything becomes back to how it should be with local food, local everything, bartering, everything in a loving way. And it's not impossible.
Do you think it'll happen?
I think it will have no choice but happen unless it's the end of the human race, because globalization ain't going to do it for us.
Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, it's me again. Thanks for listening to that. What an incredible lady Sarah is. I just wanted to remind you that today's podcast is supported by LAT56. LAT56 are an incredible luggage company that really help me travel around the world, making sure my suits don't get crumpled up when I'm going from concert to concert. And quite frankly, these things are indestructible and they look amazing. I'd really recommend them, so please visit LAT56.com to see more information about them. Again, if you really liked what you've heard today, please, please go on to Apple Podcasts or any other platform that you've been listening to and write a review. The reviews are really important for me to get a bit of traction for the show, and if you'd like, please do feel free to write to me and let me know if there's anybody in particular you'd like me to interview next, and I'll see what I can do. Apart from that, that's me done for another day, so ciao for now. Thanks very much.
The Backstage Blog.